This is chapter 4 of the life of Henry Martin, and by George Smith, published in 1892. And we last left our subject, Henry Martin, in Calcutta, having had a long and very interesting sea voyage to that very place. So chapter 4, may God be pleased to bless and encourage us as we listen to this book, this history of a Christian missionary, Henry Martin. This is India and the East in the year 1806. Henry Martin reached India and entered on his official duties as chaplain and the work of his heart as missionary to North India at a time when the Anglo-Indian community had begun to follow society in England in a reformation of life and manners and in corresponding desire to do good to the natives. The evangelical reactions set in motion by the Pietists, Moravians and Marrowmen, John Wesley and Whitfield, Andrew Fuller and Simeon, John Erskine and the Haldanes, had first affected South India and Madras, where Protestant Christian missions were just a century old. The Danish Hallymen, led by Ziegenblaug and Schwartz, had found support in the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge from the year 1709. So early as 1716, an East India Company's chaplain, the Reverend William Stevenson, wrote a remarkable letter to that society, quote, concerning the most effectual way of propagating the gospel in this South India part of the world, end quote. He urged a union of the several agencies in England, Denmark and Germany into one common society for promoting the Protestant missions, the formation of colleges in Europe to train missionaries, the raising of an annual income of £3,000, and the maintenance therewith of a staff of at least 8 well-qualified missionaries. By a century and a half, he anticipated the proposal that union which gives strength and charity, the erection of colleges at Trankebar and Madras to train native ministers, catechists and schoolmasters, and the opening of free schools in every considerable place superintended by the European missionaries on the circle system. Another Madras chaplain, the Reverend George Lewis, was no less friendly and helpful to Ziegenbalg. He was Mr. Stevenson's predecessor and wrote in 1712 in North India, where the casteless races of the hills corresponding to the Shanars around Cape Comorin were not discovered till far on in the present century. Almost everything was different. By the time that the Evangelical Church directed its attention to Calcutta, the East India Company had become a political and consequently an intolerant power. It feared Christian proselytism, and it encouraged Hindu and Mohammedan beliefs and institutions. Whereas in Madras, it gladly used Schwartz, subsidised the mission with 500 pagodas or £225 a year, and had always conveyed the missionaries' freight in its ships free of charge. In Bengal, it kept out missionaries, or so treated them, with all the rigour of the law against interlopers, that William Carey had to begin his career as an indigo planter and seek protection in Danish Serampore, where he became openly and only a preacher and teacher of Christ. North India, too, with Calcutta and Benares as its two Hindu centres, and Lucknow and Delhi as its two Mohammedan centres, Shia and Sunni, was and is the very citadel of all the non-Christian world. The same gospel which had proved the power of God to the simple demonolaters of the Dravidian south must be shown to be the wisdom of God to the Kulin of Bengal, the Brahmin of Kazi, the fanatical Muslim from Datsa, and ultimately to Peshawar and Kabul, Persia and Arabia. The Himalayan and Gangetic land from which Buddhism overran eastern and southern Asia must again send forth a missionary message to call Cathay to Christ, Cathay being China, I guess. The Christianizing of North India began in 1758, the year after the Battle of Plassey, when, as governor, the conqueror Clive welcomed his old acquaintance of the Cuddalore mission, the Swede Kiananda, to Calcutta, and gave him a rent-free house for 8 years. Even Burke was friendly with Clive, writing of him, "Lord Clive once thought himself obliged to me for having done what I thought an act of justice towards him." and it is pleasant thus to be able in any way to link that name with the purely spiritual force which used the Plassey and the Mutiny Wars, as it will direct all events for making India Christ's. The first church, built in 1715 by the merchants and captains, had been destroyed by a hurricane. The second had been demolished by Suraj Ud Daula in the siege of Calcutta 2 years before, and one of the two chaplains had perished in the black hole while the other was driven away. For the next 30 years, the few who went to the chaplain's church worshipped in a small bungalow in the old fort where Kiananda opened his first school. By 1771-4, he had formed such a congregation of poor Christians, Portuguese, Roman Catholics and Bengali converts that he built and extended the famous mission church and schoolhouse at a cost of £12,000, received from both his marriages. When, by becoming surety for another, the old man lost his all and blindness added to his sorrows, he left an English congregation of 147 members and a native congregation of 119, half Portuguese or Eurasians and half Bengali. Kiananda's mission church was the centre of the religious life of Calcutta and Bengal. 6 years after its foundation, there came to Calcutta from Madras Mr. William Chambers, who had been converted by Schwartz, and John Christian Obeck, who had been one of the catechists of the Apostle of South India. Chambers had not been a year in the capital when he found out Charles Grant, at that time overwhelmed by a domestic sorrow, and brought him to Christ. Grant soon after went to Malda as commercial resident, where he had his subordinates, George Udney, Ellerton, W. Brown, W. Grant, J. Henry and Creighton. These men, with their families, Sir Robert Chambers of the Supreme Court, Mrs. Anne Chambers, who was with her sons, Mrs. Chapman and others less known, formed the nucleus of a Christian community which first supported Thomas as a medical missionary, then welcomed Carey and, with the assistance of two Governor-Generals, Sir John Shaw and Lord Wellesley, changed the tone of Anglo-Indian society. Sir William Jones, too, in his brief career of 6 years, set an example of all the virtues. Henry Martin had two predecessors as evangelical chaplains and missionary philanthropists, the Yorkshire David Brown and the Scottish Claudius Buchanan. David Brown, an early friend of Simeon and fellow of Magdalen College, was recovering from a long illness in 1785, when a letter reached him from London proposing that he should seek ordination, and in 10 days he accompanied Captain Kirkpatrick to Calcutta to superintend the military orphan school. The officers of the Bengal army had unanimously resolved to tax themselves for the removal and prevention of the scandal caused by the number of boys and girls left destitute. No fewer than 500 at that time. This noble school, the blessings of which were soon extended to the white and coloured offspring of non-commissioned officers and soldiers also, was organised by Brown, who then afterwards made chaplain to a brigade, and afterwards one of the Fort William or Presidency chaplains. He found the mission practically non-existent, owing to Kiananda's losses and old age. To save the buildings from sale by the sheriff, Charles Grant bought them for 10,000 rupees and vested them in himself, Mr. A. Chambers and Mr. Brown, by a deed providing that they remain appropriate to the sole purposes of religion. Until the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge could send out a minister, David Brown greatly extended the work of Kiananda. At one time it was likely that Henry Martin would be sent out by Mr. Grant. Under the Church Missionary Society, the Mission Church of Calcutta has ever since been identified with all that is best in pure religion and missionary enterprise in the city of Calcutta. When sending out the Reverend A.T. Clark, B.A., of Trinity College, Cambridge, who soon after became a chaplain, the Christian Knowledge Society, referring to Schwartz and Germany, fertile in missionaries, declared, "It has been the surprise of many and the lamentation of more that fortitude thus exemplified should not have inspired some of our own clergy with an emulation to follow and to imitate these champions of the cross, thus seeking and thus contending to save them who are lost." That was in 1789, when the Society and Dr. Watson, Bishop of Llandaff, along with Simeon, Wilberforce and the other Clapham men, had before it officially the request of Charles Grant Chambers and Brown to send out 8 English missionaries on £350 a year each to study at Benar Ares and attack Hinduism in its very centre. Excuse me. Not till 1817 was the First Church of England missionary as such, the Reverend William Greenwood, to settle in Ceylon and then in Bengal. Even he became rather an additional chaplain to the invalid soldiers at Chennai. After a career not unlike that of John Newton, who first directed his attention to India, Claudius Buchanan, whom his father had intended to educate for the ministry of the Church of Scotland, wandered to London, was sent to Queen's College, Cambridge by Mr. Thornton of Clapham, there came under Simeon's influence and was appointed to Bengal as a chaplain by Mr. Grant. That was in 1796. For the next 10 years in Barrackpore and Calcutta, as the trusted chaplain of Lord Wellesley, by his researches in South India, by his promotion of Bible translation, and by the interest in the Christianizing of India, which his generous prizes excited in the universities and churches of England and Scotland, Dr. Claudius Buchanan was the foremost ecclesiastic in the East. He at once gave an impulse to the silent revolution which David Brown began and the Serampore missionaries carried on. His Christian statesmanship commended him to all the authorities, and soon the new cathedral of St. John, which Warren Hastings had erected to supersede the old bungalow church, became filled with an attentive and devout congregation, as well as the mission church. These two men and William Carey formed the pillars of the College of Fort William, by which Lord Wellesley not only educated the young civilians and military officers in the Oriental languages and in their duties to the natives, but developed a high ideal of public life and personal morality. Such was the growth of Christian feeling alike in the army and the civil service, and such the sense of duty to the rapidly increasing Eurasian community, as well as to the natives, that by 1803 Claudius Buchanan submitted to the Governor-General, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Bishop Porteous, his thoughts on the expediency of an ecclesiastical establishment for British India. It took 10 years, covering the whole period of Henry Martin's activities and life, from this time for the proposal to be legislatively carried out in the East India Company's Charter of 1813. Practically except in Malda residency during the influence of Grant, Udney and Carey at the end of last century, the Reformation was confined to Calcutta, as we shall see. It was a young lieutenant of the Company's army who was the first to draw the attention of the Governor-General, Sir John Shaw, in 1794, to the total neglect of religion in Bengal. Lieutenant White wrote that he had been 11 years in the country without having had it in his power to hear the public prayers of the church above 5 times. He urged the regular worship of God, the public performance of divine service, and preaching at all the stations. He proposed additional chaplains to the company's complement for considerable places, which now have none to officiate. Unless places were erected at the different stations for assembling to divine service, it must be impossible for chaplains even to be able to do their duty and to assemble the people together. The letter delighted the Governor-General, who said of it to David Brown, "I shall certainly recommend places to be made at the stations and shall desire the General, who is going up the country, to take this matter in charge and to fix on spots where chapels shall be erected." Nothing was done in consequence of this, however. It was left to Martin and the other chaplains, who were in earnest, to find or create covered places for worship at the great military stations. Claudius Buchanan himself could not hold regular services at Barrackpore, close to Calcutta, for want of a church, and that was supplied long after by adapting and consecrating the station theatre. The figures in Buchanan's published memoir on the expediency of an ecclesiastical establishment enable us to estimate exactly the spiritual destitution of the Protestant subjects of the British government in Asia. 12 years after Lieutenant White, Sir John Shaw, David Brown and Claudius Buchanan first raised the question, and when Henry Martin began his ministrations to all classes, there were 676,557 Protestant subjects in India, Ceylon, Java, Sumatra and Canton, Roman Catholics and Syrian Christians not included. In the three presidencies of India alone, there were 156,057, of whom 7,257 were civil and military officers and inhabitants, 6,000 were Company's European troops, 19,800 were the King's troops, 110,000 were Eurasians, and 13,000 were native Protestant Christians at Tanjore. In Bengal alone, that is North India, there were 50 stations, 31 civil and 19 military, many of which had been without the offices of religion for 20 years past, though at each there reside generally a judge, a collector, a commercial resident, with families together with their assistants and families, and a surgeon, also indigo planters, tradesmen and other European inhabitants, and the alarmingly large number of Eurasians. In Bengal alone, there were 13,299 European Protestants, of whom 2,467 were civil servants and military officers. Of the whole, 13,299, a tenth part, do not return to England and desire Christian education and confirmation for their children. Yet at present there are but three churches in India, chief of which was aided in construction by Hindu contribution. The India journals and letters of Martin must be read in the light of all this. It was thus that the successive generations of soldiers and civilians who won for Christian England its Indian Empire in the century from Clive to Wellesley, Hastings and Dalhousie were de-Christianized. Not till the close of the Mutiny War in 1858 did John Lawrence, first as Lieutenant Governor of the Punjab and then as Viceroy, and Sir Robert Montgomery as Lieutenant Governor, lead the Queen's government to do its duty by erecting or helping Christians to erect a chapel in every station up to Peshawar and Burma. That, to use Buchanan's language in 1806, the English soldiers and our countrymen of all descriptions, after long absence from a Christian country, may recognise a church, including Ceylon. Buchanan's scheme proposed an annual expenditure of $144,000 for four dioceses, with 50 English chaplains and 100 native curates, 200 schoolmasters and four colleges to train both Europeans and natives for the ministry. Of this, Parliament gave $100,000. The ecclesiastical establishment of India, without Ceylon, but including Church of Scotland chaplains and grants to Wesleyans and Roman Catholics, now costs India itself £160,000 a year. This is being written in 1892. While the annual value of the lands devoted to the non-Christian cults is many millions sterling, with all this, and the aid of the additional clergy and Anglo-Indian evangelicalization societies and of the missionaries to the natives, Great Britain does not meet the spiritual wants of the now enormous number and scattered communities of Christian soldiers and residents in its Indian Empire. Henry Martin went out to India at a time when the government of India had been temporarily entrusted to one of the only three or four incompetent and unworthy men who have held the high office of Governor General. Sir George Barlow was a Bengal civilian of the old type, whom Lord Wellesley had found so zealous and useful in matters of routine that he had recommended him as Provisional Governor General. But the moment that that proconsul had seated the East India Company on the throne of the Great Mogul, as has been said, and Lord Cornwallis, who had been hurried out a second time to undo his magnificent and just policy, had died at Ghazipur, Sir George Barlow showed the most disastrous zeal in opposition to all his former convictions. By withholding from India the lamentable dispatch of September 19, 1805, which Lord Cornwallis had signed when the unconsciousness of death had already weakened his efficiency, Lord Lake gave the civil authorities a final opportunity to consider their ways. But Barlow's stupidity, now clothed with the almost dictator's power of the highest office under the British Crown, as it was in those days, deliberately declared it to be his desire not only to fix the limit of our empire at the Jumna, a river fordable by an enemy at all times, but to promote general anarchy beyond that frontier as the best security for British peace within it. The peace of southern Asia and the good of its peoples were postponed for years, till, with difficulty, the Marquis of Hastings restored the empire to the position in which Lord Wellesley had left it. Sir George Barlow is responsible for the 12 years' anarchy of British India from 1805 to 1817. His administration, which became such a failure that he was removed to Madras and was from even that province recalled, must rank as a blot on the otherwise unbroken splendour and benevolence to the subject races of the government of South Asia in the century and a half from Clive to Lord Lansdowne. The man who from dull stolidity, more than from Machiavellian craft, thus again plunged half India into a series of wars by chief upon chief and creed upon creed, was no less guilty of intolerance to Christianity within the Company's territories. On the one hand, in opposition to the views of Lord Wellesley, and even of the Court of Directors led by Charles Grant, he made the Company's government the direct manager of the Puri Temple of Jagannath and its dancing girls. On the other, he would have banished the Serampore and all Christian missionaries from the country, but for the courageous opposition of the little governor of that Danish settlement. All too late, he was relieved by Lord Minto, whom the Brahmanized officials of 1807 to 1810 used for a final and futile effort to crush Christianity out of India, to the indignation of Henry Martin, whose language in his journal is not more unmeasured than the intolerance deserves. But in his purely foreign policy, Lord Minto proved that he had not held the office of President of the Board of Control in vain. He once more asserted the only reason for the existence of a foreign power in India, the suppression of intestine order, cleared Bundelkund of robber chiefs and military strongholds, surrounded and assisted by the brilliant civilians and military officers whom Wellesley and Carey had trained, men like Mountstuart, Elphinstone, Metcalfe and Malcolm. Lord Minto proved equal to the strain which the designs of Napoleon Bonaparte in the Treaty of Tilsit put upon our infant empire in the east. He sent Metcalfe to Lahore and confined the dangerous power of Ranjit Singh to the north of the Sutlej. He dispatched Elphinstone to Kabul, introducing the wise policy which has converted Afghanistan into a friendly, subsidized state. And through Malcolm he opened Persia to English influence, paving the way for the embassy of Wellesley's friend, Sir Gore Ouseley, and unconsciously for the kindly reception of Henry Martin. It was on April the 22nd, 1806, at sunrise, that the young chaplain landed from the surf boat on the sands of Madras. His experience at San Salvador had prepared him for the scene which, and even for the crowds of dark natives, though not for the elegance of their manners. I felt a solemn sort of melancholy at the sight of such multitudes of idolaters, while the turbaned Asiatics waited upon us at dinner, about a dozen of them. I could not help feeling as if we had got into their places. He visited the native suburb in which the Hindustani-speaking servants dwelt, and was depressed by its appearance of wretchedness. His soul was filled with the zeal of the Old Testament prophets against idolatry, the first of which, of men, women and children, mad upon their idols, produces an impression which he does not exaggerate. I fancy the frown of God to be visible. He lost not a day in commending his master to the people. He had a good deal of conversation with a Rajput about religion and told him of the gospel. The young natives pressed upon the newcomer as usual, rose early but could not enjoy morning meditations in my walk, as the young men would attach themselves to me. He was much in the society of the Reverend Dr. Kerr and the other Madras chaplains. One of these was about to proceed to Seringapatam, where Martin urged him to devote himself to the work of preaching to the natives. This was ever foremost in his thoughts. He spent days in obtaining from Dr. Kerr a vast deal of information about all the chaplains and missionaries in the country, which he promised to put in writing for me. Schwartz was not then dead 10 years, and Dr. Kerr, who had known him and Gurick well, gave his eager listener many details of the great missionary. Felt excessively delighted with accounts of a very late date from Bengal, describing the labours of the missionaries, and was rather agitated at the confusion of interesting thoughts that crowded upon me, But I reasoned why thus. God may never honour you with a missionary commission. You must expect to leave the field and bid adieu to the world and all its concerns. On his first Sunday in India, April 27, 1806, Henry Martyn assisted in a service in the church at Fort St. George and preached from Luke 10, verses 41 and 42. One thing is needful. There was much attention, and Lord William sent to Dr. Kerr afterwards to request a copy of the sermon, but I believe it was generally thought too severe. After dinner, went to Blacktown to Mr. Lovelace Chapel. I sat in the air at the door, enjoying the blessed sound of the gospel on an Indian shore, and joining with much comfort in the song of divine praise. With young Torriano, I had some conversation respecting his entering the ministry, as he spoke the Malabar tongue fluently. Walked home at night, enjoying the presence of God. April the 28th. This morning at breakfast, Sir Edward Pellew came in and said, "Upon my word, Mr. Martin, you gave us a good trimming yesterday. As this was before a large company, and I was taken by surprise, I knew not what to say. Passed most of the day in transcribing the sermon. There was nothing very awakening in it. About 5 in the evening, I walked to Dr. Kerr's and found my way across the fields, which much resembled those near Cambridge. I stopped some time to take a view of the men drawing toddy from the tree and their manner of ploughing. April 30th. Breakfasted at Sir E. Pellew's with Captain S. Cole of the Culloden. I had a good deal of conversation about our friends at St. Hilary and Marazion. Continued at home the rest of the day transcribing sermon and reading Zechariah. In the evening drove with Dr. Kerr to Mr. Faulkner's, the Persian translator, 5 or 6 miles in the country. We had some useful conversation about the languages. On my return, walked by moonlight in the grounds, reflecting on the mission. My soul was at first sore tried by desponding thoughts, but God wonderfully assisted me to trust him for the wisdom of his dispensations. Truly, therefore, will I say again, who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain. How easy for God to do it, and it shall be done in good time. And even if I never should see a native converted, God may design by my patience and continuance in the work to encourage future missionaries. But what surprises me is the change of views I have here from what I had in England. There my heart expanded with hope and joy at the prospect of the speedy conversion of the heathen. But here the sight of the apparent impossibility requires a strong faith to support the spirits." The Lord William of the Journal is the Governor of Madras, Lord William Bentinck, whom at the beginning of his Indian career it is interesting to find thus pleasantly brought into contact with Henry Martin, just as he became the fast friend of Alexander Duff. At the close of his long and beneficent services to his country and to humanity. In 2 months thereafter, the Vellore Mutiny was to break out, through no fault of his, and he was to be recalled by an act of injustice for which George Canning and the Court of Directors atoned 20 years after by appointing him General Governor. After a fortnight off Madras, the Union once more set sail under the convoy of the Victor Sloop of War. Every moment the young scholar had sought to add to his knowledge of Hindustani and Persian, he changed his first native servant for one who could speak Hindustani. He drove with Dr. Kerr to Mr. Faulkner's, the Persian translator to government. He had some useful conversation about the languages. On the voyage to Calcutta, he was employed in learning Bengali, passed the afternoon on the poop reading Sales al-Koran. Only missionary thoughts and aspirations ruled his mind. Now despairing of his own fitness, now refreshed as he turned from the Church Missionary Society's reports to the evangelical prophecies of Malachi, again praying for the young missionaries of the London societies, he passed Vizagapatam, and for poor India as he came in sight of the Jagannath Pagoda, which, resembling in appearance Roche Rock in Cornwall, the scene presented another specimen of that tremendous gloom with which the devil has overspread the land. After taking a pilot on board in Balasore Roads, where Carey had first landed, the ship was driven out to sea by a north-wester, and Henry Martin suffered his first sunstroke. In 3 days, she anchored in the Hoogly above Culpeper, and on May the 13th, bumped on that dreaded shoal, the James and Mary. The captain considered the vessel as lost, retired as soon as possible for prayer, and found my soul in peace at the prospect of death. She floated off, exchanging most of the treasure into a tender which lay becalmed off the Garden Reach suburb, then very beautiful. Henry Martin landed at Calcutta in the height of the hot season on May the 16th, 1806. Claudius Buchanan had passed him at the mouth of the Hoogly, setting out on the tour of the coasts of India, which resulted in the Christian researchers David Brown was in his country retreat at Aldean near Serampore. The man whom, next to his own colleagues, he first sought out was the quondam shoemaker of Hackleton and poor Baptist preacher of Moulton, the Bengali missionary to whose success Charles Simeon had pointed him when fresh from the triumph of senior wrangler. The apostle, then 45 years of age, I think he's talking about William Carey there, The apostle, then 45 years of age, who was busy with the duties of professor of Sanskrit, Bengali and Marathi in the College of Fort William, that he might have the Bible translated into all the languages of Asia and preached in all the villages of North India. 1806, May the 16th. Went ashore at daylight this morning and with some difficulty found Carey, Messrs. Brown and Buchanan being both absent from Calcutta. With him I breakfasted, joined with him in worship, which was in Bengali, for the advantage of a few servants who sat, however, perfectly unmoved. I could not help contrasting them with the slaves and Hottentots at Cape Town, whose hearts seemed to burn within them. After breakfast, Carey began to translate, with a pandit, from a Sanskrit manuscript. Presently after, Dr. Taylor came in. I had engaged a boat to go to Serampore when a letter from Dr. Brown found me out and directed me to his house in the town, where I spent the rest of the day in solitude and more comfortably and profitably than any time past. I enjoyed several solemn seasons in prayer and more lively impressions from God's word. I felt elevated above those distressing fears and distractions which pride and worldliness engender in the mind. Employed at times in writing to Mr. Simeon, Mr. Brown's Munshi, a Brahmin of the name of B. Roy came in and disputed with me 2 hours about the gospel. I was really surprised at him. He spoke English very well and possessed more acuteness, good sense, moderation, and acquaintance with the scriptures than I could have conceived to be found in an Indian. He spoke with uncommon energy and eloquence, intending to show that Christianity and Hinduism did not materially differ. He asked me to explain my system and adduce the proofs of it from the Bible, which he said he believed was the word of God. When I asked him about his idolatry, he asked in turn what I had to say about our worshipping Christ. This led to inquiries about the Trinity, which, after hearing what I had to say, he observed was actually the Hindu notion. I explained several things about the Jews and the Old Testament about which he wanted information, with all which he was amazingly pleased. I feel much encouraged by this to go to instruct them. I see that they are a religious people, as St. Paul called the Athenians, and my heart almost springs at the thought that the time is ripening for the fullness of the Gentiles to come in. May the 17th. A day more unprofitable than the foregoing, the depravity of my heart, as it is in its natural frame, appeared to me today almost unconquerable. I could not, however long in prayer, keep the presence of God or the power of the world to come in my mind at all. It sunk down to its most lukewarm state and continued in general, so, in spite of my endeavours, oh, how I need a deep, heart-rending work of the Spirit upon myself, before I shall save myself, or them that hear me. What I hear about my future destination has proved a trial to me today. My dear brethren, Brown and Buchanan, wish to keep me here, as I expected, and the governor accedes to their wishes. I have a great many reasons for not liking this. I almost think that to be prevented going among the heathen as a missionary would break my heart. Whether it be self-will or aught else, I cannot yet rightly ascertain. At all events, I must learn submission to everything. In the multitude of my thoughts, thy comforts delight my soul. I have been running the hurried round of thought without God. I have forgotten that he ordereth everything. I have been bearing the burden of my cares myself, instead of casting them all upon him. Mr. Brown came in today from Serampore and gave me directions how to proceed. Continued at home writing to E. In the afternoon went on board, but without being able to get my things away. Much of the rest of the day passed in conversation with Mr. Brown. I feel pressed in spirit to do something for God. Everybody is diligent, but I am idle. All employed in their proper work, but I am tossed in uncertainty. I want nothing but grace. I want to be perfectly holy, and to save myself and those that hear me. I have hitherto lived to little purpose, more like a clod than a servant of God. Now let me burn out for God. Amen.